From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, the federal government takes aim at improving the health of the Great Lakes. Then, one of only a handful of master model builders explains the enduring appeal of Lego.
Lego can be interpreted in many different ways, that looking at one thing from one person, someone else may not see the same thing.
We learn what effect the full moon has and doesn't have on us. And a botanist walks into a bar and comes away with the idea for a book on the long history of using plants in alcoholic beverages.
We can look at ancient cave paintings and really early writings and even analyze the residue on shards of pottery at archaeological digs to see the earliest use of these plants in fermentation and distillation.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company this morning. The condition of the Great Lakes will receive its fair share of attention over the next few days. Tonight in Milwaukee, the EPA is asking for public input on the future of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, or GLRI. Over the last 4 years, the federally funded program has funneled more than $1 billion into projects such as cleaning up polluted estuaries and combating invasive species. On Friday, the Council of Great Lakes Governors will convene on Mackinac Island for a weekend's worth of meetings to advance regional priorities. Cameron Davis will be on the scene for both of those gatherings. As senior advisor to EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson, it's Davis's job to coordinate the role 16 federal agencies play in putting GLRI dollars to work around the Great Lakes. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz corralled Davis by phone as he headed towards Milwaukee. He began by rattling off a few examples of progress made during phase one of the initiative.
About 100,000 acres of wetlands, coastal wetlands, and other forms of habitat around the Great Lakes have been restored. That's a big deal. We've supported the work to keep Asian carp from becoming established in the Great Lakes. And so far, we're winning on that one. We haven't won. The battle continues, and we still need to keep up the fight. But as far as we know, Asian carp have not made it into the Great Lakes in self-sustaining populations, so we want to keep up that effort. Another one, beaches are getting healthier. For example, in Chicago, beach closing swimming bans were at a five-year low based in part on the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative.
What do you think is most critical pressing ahead now with the second phase? What is most critical, do you think?
Yeah, well, this answer may surprise you, but I think the most critical thing right now is to battle complacency. It can seem overwhelming to restore the Great Lakes. It can seem like a real task to try to breathe a new life back into these waterways that we all love and care about. But it's like anything else that is a big job. You take it one step at a time, and every year you do more and you accelerate your efforts. And the key issues don't change all that much from year to year. They may vary a little bit by the decade, but I think in the coming years for the next increment of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, we're looking at continuing the fight against invasive species like Asian carp. We're looking at reducing runoff from farmland that can cause harmful algae downstream. We're looking at cleaning up our toxic hotspot areas of concern, places around Milwaukee Harbor and the rivers that still have toxic sediments in them that need to get cleaned up, rebuilding habitat, and of course, just making sure that we're accountable for getting all these things done.
One of the concerns that many people are focused on are lake levels,
sure.
Erratic weather that we have. Is that becoming increasingly front page? We have to think of this in every endeavor that we take on to improve the health of the Great Lakes?
Well, you're asking a fantastic question, and I'm hoping that when we have the public meeting that people give us their best ideas about how we can use the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative to ensure the resiliency of the Great Lakes system. And I do think part of it means building into every effort, every project, a component that ensures that that project, the results of that project won't get wiped out or damaged over time as a result of extreme weather conditions that we're seeing. So I do think that that's part of it. I really believe that if we do all of the things that we say we're going to do under the existing action plan and what I know will be the next iteration of that action plan, all of those things combined will help make the Great Lakes ecosystem much more resilient in the face of extreme weather.
Tonight you're holding a public forum in Milwaukee. You're going to be moving on to another, and you've got webcasts in between. What are you hearing so far from people?
So we kicked off our public forums last week. We did a webinar, which was really helpful. We had a public meeting in Buffalo Tuesday night. And one of the things that we are hearing from people is, number one, keep the investments coming. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is just a tremendous accelerator for getting good work done to help keep the Great Lakes healthy. Another thing that we're hearing from people is, while we keep the good work going on the ground and in the water, don't forget to educate the next generation. If we think the issues and the problems that we're facing, the management decisions that we're facing today are complex, they're going to be much more complex in the future. And we've got to get the next generation ready to be able to handle the decisions that they're going to have to make to help manage the Great Lakes and pick up that mantle. So those are just a few things that we're hearing. One of the great things about this region is that people are not shy. They have a lot of ideas about the Great Lakes, and just as the Great Lakes are big, we have just as many ideas out there coming from people about how we need to target our efforts across the board.
Explain, if you would, the status of funding.
Sure. So we've been very fortunate. President Obama proposed $475 million the first year of the GLRI, as we call it, and that was in fiscal year 10. It's been about $300 million since then, proposed and appropriated by Congress. We're waiting now for the FY14 fiscal year work and the budget to be passed by Congress. We'll see what that means. Bottom line, more than $1 billion worth of federal investments, and these are investments. You know, anybody who suggests that this is just the expenditure of federal dollars, you know, what I'd say is, well, you know, if you're putting money into a retirement fund for yourself, you're not spending money, you're investing money in the future of life. And that's exactly what the GLRI is doing. It's investing in the future of the Great Lakes. Just as our homes need upkeep, the Great Lakes need upkeep as well if they're going to continue to take care of us. And the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is really a key program to help ensure that that happens.
You're 4 years into your job. I'm not going to ask you the challenge question, but you come from part of your background is having led the Alliance for the Great Lakes, an advocacy group. And I'm sure in that position you were juggling stakeholders and views about who has more or less right to it. How is that juggling? As you said, you report to and advise a number of different people and share your views and your passion for the Great Lakes. It's not an easy job.
Well, I think the training I got running a nonprofit was excellent training because it really taught me the value of public service. And this job is really no different. This is public service work at its best. It's about a resource, a common resource that we all love and care about, and it's something that we borrow from our children, and making sure that it's around for them. It's around to support jobs and recreation, quality of life, here to support the economy of the region, all of those things. And also, there's been, a great learning curve in terms of working with different agencies with different missions and trying to get everybody on the same page. That really doesn't change too much. The scale of it does, and maybe the responsibility does, but you know, I think what's critical is that we listen. And that's what tonight is all about when we host the public meeting, is to hear what people have to say about their vision for a healthier Great Lakes going into the future.
There are those who are skeptical of federal agencies. Are you or aren't you using our money effectively? I assume you must very carefully quantify how these monies are being spent and what kind of impact they're having. Do you see some attitudes and barriers breaking down, or is that too naive to think that could happen?
Well, mostly people are incredibly supportive, and I think that's because of the Great Lakes themselves. People understand that just as the West may have the Rockies and the South may have the Gulf of Mexico, and the list goes on, we have the Great Lakes. There's no other place like it in the world. And as the world gets thirstier and thirstier, I think more and more people are understanding that we have a real gift here, and we've got to make sure that we're good stewards of it. So most of the folks out there really are supportive. They want to see our investments continue. Now, for those who are skeptical or have questions or concerns, we really welcome those because we can't do our best to make sure that we're making the best decisions unless people are raising questions and unless folks are suggesting a better way to do things. So for tonight's public meeting, that's what I really welcome is, if folks have concerns, we want to hear them. The only thing I ask is that they be constructive. If there's a better way to do things, let us know what your ideas are, because the 16 federal agencies that are all working to help restore the Great Lakes, they really need that input.
You'll be moving on from Milwaukee, I believe, to Mackinac Island, where Great Lakes governors and their corresponding provincial leaders will be meeting. Will you be addressing the group?
Well, I'll be there as an observer. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is something that the governors in the states have had a keen interest in for the past several years. Really, hundreds of millions of dollars have gone to the states for investments in their Great Lakes parts of the region. And this summit, this weekend on Mackinac Island, is really going to be telling as to whether the governors will continue to support the GLRI or not. And I'm real hopeful that they will.
Does it come down to a vote on their position on GLRI?
Well, I think there are many things that the governors are going to be considering this weekend. And I don't know that it will come down to a vote, but I do think that an expression of support from the governors will really go a long way to continuing the vibrancy of the program.
WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz spoke with Cameron Davis, who is senior advisor to EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson and is chief liaison to Capitol Hill on Great Lakes issues. He'll be in Milwaukee tonight at the Urban Ecology Center, Riverside Park, for a public hearing about the future of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. You can weigh in tonight in person or submit a comment online until July 12th to make your voice heard. You can find out the link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. You'll also find information there on the Council of Great Lakes Governors that will convene over the weekend in Mackinac Island. What does it take to become a Lego Master Model Builder? Well, coming up next, we'll talk with Andrew Johnson, who holds that title in the Schaumburg Lego Discovery Center. Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, right after this. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Many of us grew up playing with Lego, those mostly gray rectangles that snap together. And most of us were content building bridges and forts and sometimes cars and trucks. But there were always people who took their designs beyond the expected, and Andrew Johnson was one of those people. Johnson is currently a Legoland Discovery Center Master Model Builder at the Lego Center in Schaumburg, Illinois. He competed for the job against seven other finalists in a build-off contest in 2012. He's currently one of only a handful of people in the United States and even around the world to hold the title. Johnson was in Milwaukee last month with some very intricate models that he designed and built, and he joined me in the studio then. Andrew, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
And welcome to Harry Potter, too.
Yeah, he's a little shy, so we'll see how he does.
We'll see if he actually says anything. So Harry is about 4 feet tall?
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, and how long did he take you to make?
Takes about 50 hours. Yeah, the face, wherever there's the most detail, that's what takes the longest. So definitely on him, the face and the hair.
And it's incredibly lifelike. And when you consider that Legos are essentially rectangular or square.
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah, that to actually get curvature and to get the eye, like eyebrows. I'm looking at eyebrows.
Yeah.
And how are the eyes made? His eyes are a very bright blue.
Yeah, so his eyes are a mix of some, they're called plates, the flat pieces. And then a couple circular Lego with no studs or like the little dots that are on top of all the Lego. So it's flat. The eyes, I would say eyes are one of the hardest things to do.
And to make them look good.
Yeah, exactly. Because they can look very scary if you don't do them right.
Now, this is all because you are a Lego master builder. You are one of about eight in the world. Is that right?
I think it's gone up a couple because there's one master model builder at every Legoland. And we just opened one up in Westchester, New York, one in Toronto. So it's probably up to like 10.
Okay.
Now.
Yeah, still not very many.
Yeah.
So what does it take to become a master model builder for Lego? Mm-hmm. And how did you get interested in even trying to do such a thing?
Well, I've been interested in Lego, I mean, since I started playing with them when I was very little. I actually got more into them, and especially 3D sculpting larger sculptures in college. I did it as a summer job, working with Lego at education camps. And in my off time or in between classes, I just kind of started building my own creations and realized I had that spatial awareness that I hadn't really tapped into before. And then the application for this job was in a local newspaper. My dad's like, hey, you should try this out. Getting paid to play with toys is not a bad gig. So I applied, and the process was resume and a YouTube video. And then they narrowed it down to eight of us, and we had a build-off.
And okay. That's,
so I technically won my job.
You won your job.
Yeah.
What was the build-off like? I assume that was timed?
It was. So there were me and seven others, and we were actually at the center in Schaumburg in our 4D movie theater. So we were sitting along the front, and it fits about 75 to 100 people. So there were people rotating in and out while we were building. There were 2 half-hour rounds and 1 hour round. They were all themed, and we weren't told what the theme was until the round was about to start. So we had very little time to prepare. And we were just given, like, a random box of Lego, and that's what we were able to use for the whole thing.
Of all the models that you built during that build-off, what was the one that you were the most proud of?
I think I may have just started out really well, and that helped me out. The first round was anything that had to do with Chicago. We had 30 minutes. Someone attempted to build the bean, which is, I mean, the curve on that, and doing it on a small scale is very difficult. So kudos to them for even trying. Someone built a deep dish pizza, and I lived downtown and went to DePaul down in Chicago. So I'd walk by the Daily Plaza, which has a sculpture called the Picasso. And I chose that not only because I really like art and Picasso specifically, but it's called the Picasso because no one knows exactly what it is because he never told anyone. It wasn't so much the model, which did turn out decently, but more the story I had behind the model, which was how Lego can be interpreted in many different ways, that looking at one thing from one person, someone else may not see the same thing. So I think kind of just bringing that perspective to the competition kind of already gave me an edge right from the get-go.
Do you think that that kind of ability to look at things not from a typical perspective makes a better model builder than somebody who can just follow the directions?
Well, since we are making models that no one's ever made before, there are no directions. So
right.
Yeah, that's definitely one thing. But I think more than anything, it's being able to kind of picture what you want it to look like before you even start building. I've realized that I kind of just can do that in my head and then make something look the way I want it to, or even just take a 2D image and make it 3D. And I've realized more and more talking to people that not everybody can do that, which I had never really thought about before. So more than anything, it's definitely the 3D aspect of it and being able to kind of create something out of thousands of tiny little brick.
Right, so, that are all the same shape.
Exactly, yeah.
But that you can somehow see that in space, that you know, you see all the sides of it.
Yeah, even just because, I mean, there's several hundred different pieces. So even knowing what piece would fit in a certain place, because you don't always have that piece in front of you at the time. So, yeah, definitely being familiar with Lego, too, has also helped.
You know, there's been some criticism in recent years that Lego is making it a little too easy for people, not at your level, but for people, you know, who are playing with it or just building it, that there are so many specialized kits, you know, particular themes or characters that the imagination that you're talking about, the ability to kind of see something in your head and then create it, maybe getting lost a little bit. I mean, do you agree with that?
I could definitely see where people are coming from with that. And that's one of the biggest things that I do at the center. Whenever I have free time, I'll just go out on the floor, hang out with kids and build stuff. I mean, at a very young age, I would say it's important to use those kits just to become familiar with pieces. There are actually a lot of good tips in those instructional sets, different ways of building that are really hard to just pick up on your own. So it does give you a head start using the kits. But then I've always given advice just as kids get older to shy away from those. They've kind of gotten the building down and to really come up with something on their own that they really have to use their imagination and creativity on. So as long as you keep it balanced and as you do progress, kind of get into your own building niche and way of building, I guess.
Yeah, how you approach it.
Yeah, you really just have to push kids to get into that.
Or give them the freedom to do
exactly,
it.
Exactly,
yeah. And kids, too. I mean, people talk about this all the time, mm-hmm. how our world is so digital and so not as hands-on as it once was. Do you find that Lego is still enduring, that kids are still really flocking to it?
I think it actually, there was a huge boom in Lego in the late 90s, even early 2000s, with the ability for anybody to have access to stop motion software. So stop motion videos, the kind of creation of YouTube and anybody being able to upload videos. I think it kind of brought Lego back and even kind of helped them get pushed into the more digital side.
Yeah, when you're, you know, hanging out with the kids mm-hmm. at Legoland, do you find that that's how they're thinking about using Lego, or are there as many ways of using it as there are kids who are using it?
That's one great thing about Lego is you have freedom to use it in so many different ways. I mean, I've had kids come in and show me things they've built just for like their room, like coat hangers out of Lego, things like that. You can just use it for a lot of different things. People use it like instead of like somewhere to throw your keys, you use Lego brick attached to your keys and they hold up on the wall. And then there are things, there's other programs. One's called, it's free to download on the website. It's Lego Digital Designer. It's actually a 3D modeling program that's very basic that kids can use easily. And I always kind of push just for kids to be able to use that because even if you do buy a ton of sets, you're never going to have every piece that's available. And that has all the pieces, it updates, and kids can create their own things without physically having to have the pieces there. But they're still learning the same techniques and creating something on their own. And then they can find the pieces they'll need later and build it. So there's definitely, I think Lego has been able to bridge the gap.
They're not
getting cut off by technology at all, I don't think, which is good.
So there's still that hands-on actually putting stuff together mm-hmm. and figuring out how that works in three dimensions as well as doing the digital mm-hmm. stuff.
Yeah. I maybe sit at my desk for an hour or two a day, not even. So I'm always hands-on. That's the way I like to go.
Do you find that Lego is predominantly boys, or are girls really getting into it now?
Well, at the center, we actually have about a 50-50, boys and girls coming into the center. I know Lego's tried a couple times with different girl-themed sets, and the latest one, which is called Lego Friends, has definitely gained a lot more momentum. It's a lot more accepted, and they're really expanding those sets. There's Lego City, which is like police stations, forest preserve stations, all that kind of stuff. Girls love those.
They're using them, basically.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Girls love Star Wars, so I don't think it's cutting off girls from any of the sets. They do maybe go a little more towards boys, but I know that some girls love them as much as any boy does.
Well, it's just nice to know that the girls are in there building them too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is really cool. The Lego Leagues, the proliferation mm-hmm. of Lego Leagues, do you think that kind of competition is healthy for the creativity part, like the art part of doing what you do, as opposed mm-hmm. to the sort of the science of just like getting stuff built? And
yeah, it really depends which way you want to go, because I mean, normal Lego brick lends itself more to just the creative side of building and art, whereas those Lego Leagues, a lot of them they're called NXT Mindstorms. They're robotic kits, so they actually have an electronic board. You can plug them into the computer. There's software attached to it, and that's all created by Lego as well. It's more like a BattleBots League type thing. And that definitely lends itself more to the science and math, computer software aspect, which isn't bad either. You're still using Lego. I think it's definitely important to kind of have that balance. I've worked with those kits as well. But personally, I just like the art side of it, but that's just me. So it is good. There's different ways you can go about using Lego, and you can really find those more science aspects of it if you want to. And I don't think it's takes anything away from Lego. If anything, it just adds to it.
So, yeah, one more dimension
to
it.
Definitely.
Do you think that Lego is going to continue to be popular, that kids are going to continue to want to do this? And if so, why?
Well, I think just looking at history, it's already lasted 50-plus years. I know there are a lot of new kits and different pieces coming out, but the original 2x4, the model for it hasn't changed in probably 40 years. It uses the same mold. So I think I don't think the Lego brick will ever go away. There may be some little side things that kind of drop off the map as they aren't really as relevant anymore. But I think definitely picking up the Mindstorms, that more science base, and I think having the Discovery Centers and Lego Lands just makes that environment overall more accessible to people. They can visit and see what is possible instead of just being able to check out a Lego store or the website. it's a lot more immersive experience that kids can take a lot away from, I think.
What is your favorite piece that you've built so far?
As part of the application process, we had to take a picture with our favorite Lego creation. And most of the creations up to that point I'd built at the camp I worked at, so I didn't take any of them home. So I went out and bought maybe 6 or 7 just bulk Lego kits, just the normal pieces. They were instructional sets. I tried to come up with a model that had a lot to do with my own passions and hobbies. So I love film, and I played volleyball in high school and college. So I built the Wilson volleyball from Castaway. So that's probably one of my favorite models.
What a great thing to build.
Oh, yeah. Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
One of my favorites.
Exactly. And what a great character, because it was a character.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep.
So if someone listening to this or the parent of someone listening to this says, geez, you know, I'd like to try to become a master model builder for Lego, what do you suggest that they do?
We're opening up some new sites next year, I think. I actually replaced a master model builder. So I've been here a little over a year. Besides me, everyone's still been at the site since it opened because they usually hold the competition right before the grand opening. So the master model builders, I don't know if any of us are leaving anytime soon. I know I'm not. I mean, there's Lego designers. There's something called Lego Studios in California and England. They're just more warehouse types where it's a group of model builders who just build mass production things. Like, I was out in the one in California last year, and they were working on models for the new Legoland Hotel. So they're just pure model building, whereas I do different things around the center, hanging out with kids. They're definitely more the pure builders.
So there's room
there
for—
There are different— Master model builder is not the only job you'd be able to play with toys all day.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. Because I'm sure there are people listening to it going, I want to do that.
Yeah.
Well, Andrew, again, it has been such a pleasure having you in. Thank you for bringing Harry.
Definitely.
He's been very quiet.
Yeah, I don't. Maybe I just covered everything. He doesn't really have to chime in.
He probably doesn't really have to chime in.
Yeah.
But thanks for bringing him along.
Definitely.
And
enjoy
your time in Milwaukee.
I will. Definitely.
Andrew Johnson is the master model builder for Legoland Discovery Center Chicago, which is located in Schaumburg. He was in Milwaukee last month, complete with a 4-foot-tall Lego model of Harry Potter. There are photos and more information about it all on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. The full moon may hit your eye like a big pizza pie when you're in love, but does it really affect the rate of emergency room admissions and episodes of mental illness? We separate the myths from reality when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us. Jean Creighton joins me, as she does each month, to talk about things astronomical. Hello, Jean.
Hello, Bonnie.
Welcome to spring, almost summer. This is fantastic that it's actually a little warmer and lovely. And we've been all looking up in the sky, seeing what's up there. And of course, most of the time when the moon is full, we see the moon unless there's cloud cover. And today we're going to talk about the moon and some of the myths that the moon engenders that kind of go across cultures, because there are a lot of ideas that we have about how the moon affects us, I think, that may or may not be true. And I think you're going to tell me some of the things that I think might be true aren't. So let's start with some of the things. What do people think about the moon and how it affects us? And then, are any of them true?
There are many, many studies about how the moon affects any number of things. And I'm just going to touch on a few, but literally you can go from violence in prisons to casino payout rates. All kinds of things have been correlated, if you will, or at least studied against the moon phases. But I'll start with the birth of babies. The most significant clinical sort of trial that I've seen is 40 years of data. This was in France, over 30 million babies, and they found a very small correlation. Many find none, but this was a very long, long study. And they found that at a very small point, the full moon has a few more babies. So to give you some numbers to wrap your head around, 9 extra babies for every 2,000 a day that are born in France.
So the idea is that the full moon causes women to go into labor sooner, or to go into labor and to birth babies at that point. Is that the
Thank
idea?
You for saying that. No.
No.
This is not causation.
Okay.
We're just seeing that when there's a full moon, there seems to be a very small number of increase in births.
Okay.
We do not prove that way that there's causality. It's just suggests that maybe there is. But many other studies have found none whatsoever. What I found was interesting is that the day of the week is well understood, that any individual weekday is going to be much more likely to have babies than any weekend day, which I wouldn't have expected. I don't know why that would be, and I'm sure that people are trying to figure that out. The other aspect of this that I found amusing was that people thought that maybe barometric pressure, so if you have a low system or weather, basically, could that trigger the births of babies? And again, there hasn't been any confirmations there, but people are looking at all these different natural parameters that might somehow influence the trigger of labor.
We're talking about the possible effect that a full moon might have on human beings on Earth. And I know one of the things that you always hear is that, you know, an episode of mental illness could become worse when the moon is full. And do we find any evidence of that anywhere?
Nope.
Really? So that really is a myth.
Yeah. They look at all kinds of aspects of mental health among teenagers, among adults, other issues that are not necessarily mental health but linked to violence, violence in prisons, traffic accidents, homicide rate, you name it, and people study it. And there are no consistent connections there. In some cases, in fact, it's the other way around, that there are fewer of these episodes during the full moon, more during the new moon. And some of the violent crimes, I guess, make sense if the moon is new because it's darker outside, so it would be easier perhaps to do things that are untoward. So no, the one thing that's interesting that I didn't know is that lycanthropy, which is a fancy word for what we call werewolves, and now, of course, in the media and the movies, they're all over the place. We think that that idea might have come from the time when rye flour had a particular fungus that was a hallucinogen, so that people might have behaved strangely, and they certainly would have thought that they were somebody other than who they were. We think that might be where this whole werewolf idea came from, because we see it in a variety of different cultures. So it's not just local. We think it must have been something widespread, and something fundamental like bread would have been explaining why it was so widespread.
Right, so that there's reasons why people are, there are stories about people changing
mm-hmm.
from their normal selves into something else and then back again.
Right.
So do you think it was the whole, attaching that to the full moon might have been just an easy explanation, like it seemed maybe to happen then, or it was just more noticeable again because you could see more in the full moon?
Well, it could be that too, but also I think the moon is very dramatic, is really noticeable, eye-catching. So if something strange happens and you look up and you see the moon, then you make a mental note to yourself, oh, the moon was full and this crazy thing happened. Okay. Well, it's unlikely that 2 weeks later you look up, something crazy happens and you say, oh, the moon isn't now visible, so therefore my idea that it's somehow connected doesn't hold water. We don't think that way. So you might forget that you made that original connection because of the moon being visible at a particular time and then not noticing that it wasn't there when something else crazy happened. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely.
So I think that these kind of ideas get reinforced a little selectively.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned, you know, the idea that emergency room admissions go up during full moon, and also menstrual cycles
mm-hmm.
seem to, or people think that they tie their lunar cycles.
I have talked to a few, anyway, nurses who work in emergency rooms, and they firmly believe that there are more incidences on a full moon in the emergency room. And this is a common idea that a lot of people hold. But again, if you look at the data, the biggest data set I've seen is 150,000 admittances over a period of 4 years. There was no significant decrease. In fact, there was just no correlation between the moon, the full moon, and the admissions in the emergency room. But again, these kinds of ideas get reinforced based on what we call, it's a cognitive bias, basically, and that is we seek for evidence for what we believe already. And evidence that doesn't support idea, we tend to overlook.
So it's just the opposite of what science tries to do, which is to not go into a situation with an obvious bias or assumption. You're trying to actually find causality.
That's right.
Right.
Well, you're trying to make sure that what patterns you see, because people are very good at seeing patterns, even when they're not there, what patterns you see aren't a fluke. So you can sometimes see patterns, and you do a statistical analysis to figure out, are they significant or not? And then it's not a matter of my opinion saying, okay, well, I really want to see this, therefore I'll see it. I have to convince other people that based on the data that I have, that it really is significant, that the effect that I'm saying that I see is indeed there. And one of the other pieces that makes science powerful is it doesn't matter if I'm the only person seeing it. Even if I have this beautiful argument and even strong statistics, if nobody else can reproduce my result, then there's probably something wrong with how the data was collected or how I analyzed it.
So what about the menstrual cycle one? Because I find that fascinating. I mean, we even call them lunar cycles.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no correlation?
Well, I mean, the average woman has a menstrual cycle of about 28 days, which is a day and a half less than what the moon cycle is. So that's interesting. But when you look at large samples of cycles, then you realize that we're not as clockwork as people think. So only 3% of women over a period of a year have menstrual cycles within between 1 and 3 days of that magic 28-day. 58% of women will have a difference of more than 7 days.
On either side?
On either side.
Wow. That's huge.
That's more than half. So more than half of people are completely out of sync with the lunar cycle. And I think it's useful to remember that we're just another mammal, a lovely mammal, but another mammal. There are many other mammals, and we certainly don't find that all mammals are, in fact, most of them do not have any correlation with the moon whatsoever, not even as close as ours. And I think here the issue is there are enough mammals that, you know, some of us might decide to link closer to the moon than others. The lemur, for example, is the only mammal we know that is synchronized with the moon. I should mention, this is fascinating, I thought, that the coral has specific genes because all the coral spawns together. And how would they know? They don't have any brains. They don't have any neurons. There's a specific gene in their body that gets activated during the full moon.
So coral is connected to the full moon.
To the moon because they need some kind of trigger. And the light is, of course, a very powerful one to begin the spawning.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So there is a connection, just not the ones we might think of.
That's right.
Yeah.
So the light definitely plays a role, but we have to remember that for now thousands of years, people don't rely on the moon and the sun for light. We have many other ways, and we know that from hormones certainly respond to daily cycles and seasonal cycles, but not lunar cycles.
What do we take away from this? I mean, the moon is beautiful, and it certainly is important in our solar system, but maybe we shouldn't attach quite so much importance to it?
Well, in terms of our behavior, yes. I don't think we should use the moon as an excuse for bad behavior. But I think it does remind us how we interpret the world, that we should try and we should examine our beliefs, I guess. I think that's the take-home message. See if the data that we have supports our information and keep in mind that we tend to select for the things that we already believe.
All right. Well, Jean Creighton, I believe we'll be back again next month, lunar cycle or no. And I am so pleased to talk to you this month as always, and we'll catch you next time.
Thank you.
Lake Effect contributor and astrophysicist Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the UW-Milwaukee campus. She joins us each month to talk about things astronomical. A botanist walks into a bar, and the book she ends up writing traces the use of plants in making alcoholic drinks. From sugarcane to saffron, we travel the world with a drunken botanist next when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us.
The next time a bartender asks you what you're having, you could say you're in the mood for that heady combination of juniper, grains of paradise, wormwood, and olive. Or on second thought, perhaps you'd rather sip on that mix of barley, oak, marasca cherry, and yellow gentian. Of course, you could be kind and just order a martini or a Manhattan, but writer Amy Stewart wants you to know the plants that make up your alcoholic drink of choice. Stewart's highly entertaining book, The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks, traces the botanical history and the chemistry of the various plants that line the shelves of every well-stocked bar, and it offers recipes and suggestions for some new combinations. From the common to the obscure, the book is an, well, intoxicating read. Stewart was in Milwaukee last month to speak and sign books at the Great Lakes Distillery, and we caught up with her in Chicago before that, and she joined us on the line. Amy, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
The Drunken Botanist. Why this book? It's a wonderful book, but what possessed you to decide to go this route?
Well, you know, this was actually one of those ideas that started in a bar, believe it or not. So I was sitting around with a friend of mine who is also a horticulture writer and a landscape designer, and we were actually talking about gin, and he was saying, oh, yeah, I've never been much of a gin drinker. And I said, how can you not be interested in gin? Because if you think about it, it is nothing but a bottle full of distilled plants and really diverse and interesting plants. I mean, not just the grains that the alcohol is made out of, but also the, you know, the citrus and the juniper berries and cardamom. And I mean, all these interesting herbs and spices from really around the world. And we're sitting in this bar and I'm looking at all the bottles and saying, you know what, come to think of it, there's nothing but distilled plant matter in all of these bottles. Like, isn't that interesting? So I think at some point that night I said, you know, somebody ought to write a book about that.
And here we are with The Drunken Botanist.
Exactly,
yeah,
right.
The plants that create the world's great drinks, and they do. And they're the odd plants, unusual plants, and also common plants. I mean, things that you might not think of that actually go into some very common alcoholic drinks.
Sure, yeah. You know, I wanted to start with the plants that we actually ferment and distill and make into alcohol. And really, even that just beginning point is pretty broad because anything that has starch or sugar in it has probably been fermented and distilled somewhere around the world at some point. But obviously, you know, the usual suspects would be things like grapes and apples and corn and barley. So rice, you know, all of those plants were really my stepping off point for this.
And then you talk about, you mentioned it before, the things that flavor the alcohol, things that don't necessarily become alcohol themselves, but like juniper berries and gin, for example, that gives it that very distinct gin flavor.
Right, yeah. And that's really kind of part two. So, you know, the next thing that happens is that at the distillery, a distiller will add more plants to change the flavor. And, you know, that's, you think about beer and hops. I mean, I hear people say beer is made from hops. Well, it's not made from hops. It's flavored with hops. So, you know, that's just one of many plants that get added during the bottling phase to alter the flavor. And there are many very weird and unusual plants that get used because this is part of, you know, really our ancient history going back to, you know, how we were making medicines hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
Well, what are some of the most unusual plants that you came across that are turned into some sort of alcoholic drink?
Well, you know, some of the really odd ones around the world that people might not think of, one of my favorite ones is the monkey puzzle tree, which is a very strange-looking conifer from Chile and Argentina that grows up the West Coast and is sort of a specimen tree and maybe even a conservatory, you know, greenhouse type tree in some places around the world. And the monkey puzzle tree produces these nuts, and in its native region in Chile, native people will actually chew the nuts and use the digestive the enzymes in their saliva to help break down the sugars and start the fermentation process. So the way you make it is to actually chew and spit into a shared tub these monkey puzzle nuts, and then that makes this sort of a low alcohol, almost like a homemade beer called Mudai.
I don't know that I'd want to drink it.
I don't think it's going to catch on anytime soon. But, you know, it shows you the lengths that people will go to have a drink. right?
Exactly. And that's the thing that's just fascinated me about this book is that as human beings, we have spent an inordinate amount of time distilling things, fermenting things, trying to alter our reality with liquid.
Well, yeah. And you know, it's sort of laughable in a way. You kind of think, like, really, didn't we have more important things to do than just try to figure out a way to make a drink? But you know what? I mean, there really were some health reasons for it originally. Water was not always safe to drink. And, you know, certainly, you know, you think about Europeans coming to the Americas for the first time. You know, they were used to the water in the Thames, for instance, which was by no means safe to drink. And even sort of before the rise of big civilizations, you know, if an animal dies and falls in the river, you can't drink the water in that river. So a mildly fermented beverage was, in a way, kind of a health drink, because even a little bit of alcohol could kill off bacteria before we even knew what bacteria was. So there were some good reasons for it.
Well, the other thing you do in this book, I mean, you also have recipes, which is wonderful for all kinds of different things, but you give some, as we've been alluding to, basic history of the plants themselves. And one of the ones that I found most fascinating was the sugarcane story.
Yeah, sugarcane, you know, which is really nothing but a big overgrown grass, if you think about it. But it's kind of an amazing plant because if you picture sugarcane, you know how it has those little nodes in between each segment, those little sort of joints?
Yes.
Each one of those holds root tissue and leaf tissue, and of course there's enough sugar in the stalk to feed a young plant. So every one of those little nodes has everything inside of it to make a new plant. So it's really a survivor. But, you know, Christopher Columbus brought sugarcane to the Caribbean, so we may think of it as a Caribbean plant or even a Latin American plant, but that's very new. I mean, that was Europeans bringing it. But it's a real survivor, you know. I mean, it does well in tropical areas around the world and is so easy to replant and grow that it's no wonder Europeans took it with them everywhere they went.
Yeah, I think in the book you say that the first recorded use of it is about 6,000 B.C.
Right, yeah. And, you know, this is one of the really interesting things that I found, is that there are archaeologists and sort of ethnobotanists doing really interesting research into, you know, what was our first use of some of these plants. And it really does go back a long way. We can look at ancient cave paintings and really early writings and even analyze the residue on shards of pottery at archaeological digs to see the earliest use of these plants in fermentation and distillation.
All of this we're talking about is history. What about going forward now? Are people, and I don't even know what to call them, people who are coming up with new ways of combining plants into alcoholic drinks, are people exploring new and different ways, or have we pretty much exhausted the combinations?
Oh, no, I don't think we're anywhere near exhausting the combinations. You know, it's nice to see, especially here in the United States, we've had this real revival of craft distilleries, including, you know, throughout the Midwest. There are people making interesting whiskeys and, you know, of course, a great beer-making tradition that's continuing. But even other types of plants that you might not have thought of. So, for instance, sorghum is the fourth largest food crop in the United States after corn, wheat, and soybeans. And there's a guy in Indiana making a wonderful rum out of sorghum molasses that he gets from an Amish farmer. So a very American spirit, and really exciting to see. So I think actually we're in sort of a new age of exploration where distillers are really looking around the world for new and interesting flavors to try. And it's also a great way for distillers to work with farmers to use up some of their surplus produce. And this was originally what beer making and liquor making was really all about. It's the, you know, the potatoes or the apples that are the wrong size or a little bit blemished or otherwise unsaleable can easily be fermented and distilled and made into a product that can be sold. So it's a nice way to work with farmers as well.
I wasn't thinking about this until you just mentioned this about people moving forward and thinking about different flavors. Do you think that the lack of seed diversity and possibly plant diversity might have an effect with this, or do you think that that's not really an issue?
No, actually, it is an issue. I was really surprised when I was looking at corn, for example. I assumed that there would be bourbon distillers out there working with very unusual heirloom corn varieties. But, you know, it turned out that a lot of the people making bourbon were, they just wanted corn. You know, they were just like, we just want, you know, number two yellow field corn that's got plenty of starch in it and it's easy to work with. So it took some effort to really find somebody who was looking at heirloom varieties of corn. And I did find some. For instance, I found a grower in New York State, Tulletown Spirits, is doing, they're doing whiskey with Wapsie Valley corn, which is a, you know, a Minnesota heirloom corn that's red. And he says you can really taste a different flavor when you use these heirloom corn varieties.
Well, I would imagine you could, you know, depending on, that's the whole point of adding the flavors to the various alcohols, is to get something that's very specific and unique.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a lot of different ways to do that. I mean, you know, first of all, just making the alcohol itself, it can depend on what variety of plant you use and what kind of still. Also, what strain of yeast you use to ferment it. For instance, I talked to an apple expert, a pomologist, that's the word I was looking for, who took the same variety of apple and fermented it with different strains of yeast and got very different flavors just because of the yeast that was used. So there are a lot of different, you know, variables that go into how it ends up, you know, tasting once it's in the bottle.
Well, as a botanist and someone who obviously enjoys a drink now and then, what do you hope that non-botanists and non-distillers or brewers take away from your book?
Well, you know, I really want people to be interested in where their ingredients come from and where, you know, what's in the glass comes from. So I think that if you're a gardener, you're probably looking around at your garden seeing all kinds of new possibilities, you know, for a cocktail party that you might not have considered before. And if you're interested in cocktails, I think that just knowing this history and knowing a little bit about the ingredients and what they are can actually help you make a better drink. You know, I travel around and give talks to bartenders where I talk about, here are some other plants that are in the same plant family as the one that you're mixing drinks with. So you'll get some compatible flavors by using related plants. So that's just a little tiny bit of botany that can help explain why certain things work in the glass or don't.
Well, Amy Stewart, it has been such a pleasure talking with you. Welcome to Milwaukee, and have a great time here.
All right. Well, thank you.
Amy Stewart is an award-winning author of 6 books on the natural world, including 3 New York Times bestsellers. Her most recent book is The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks, published by Algonquin Books. She was in Milwaukee last month to speak at the Great Lakes Distillery, and we spoke with her then. And that is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.